Hello and welcome back to the LIBF Trade Finance Podcast, where we interview leading figures in the world of trade from around the globe to gain insight and discuss the issues facing industry today and the future. We also offer a range of trade and transaction banking qualifications and training. To find out more, please go to libf.ac.uk/trade. Now on with the episode. Enjoy. Hello and welcome back to the LIBF Trade Podcast. I'm Alex Gray, Head of Trade and Transaction Banking at LIBF. And happy to say I'm joined today by Kleisman Marati from Pareto Economics, formerly Pangea Wire. And we spoke back in April 2020, so people may recognize his voice. We met at that time, just prior to that, and last time I got on a plane to go overseas, that was to Helsinki. And that was just at the start of the pandemic. And just wanted to just speak to Kleisman about what he thinks has been happening in the past, 18, 19 months, because you made some predictions at that point. And I'm very happy to say, because you probably wouldn't be back if some of them were true, to be honest, weren't true. Review some of the things you talked about and how your crystal ball was quite accurate. Do you want to cover that a wee bit?
Sure. Thank you for having me back on, Alex. So when we spoke on Zoom last time, there seemed to be a consensus that wasn't really led by anyone, but was agreed on by everyone that there will be a definitive end date where we'll get back to normal. That word has been sort of the word of business since COVID happened around the world. But thinking how pandemics develop, you know, it's not as easy as signing a contract and having it finished. So you may have a situation where in one country there could be a consensus that things are back to normal, people are back to work, but across the world that may not be the case. And as we live in an interconnected world, supply chains don't listen to political decrees. You know, viruses don't stop because Boris Johnson says they stop, or they don't stop because Biden says they stop. So you will continually have, I said, supply chain disturbances, because you can't control what policies, health policies, a nation across the world has implemented, but you suffer the consequences of mismanagement. And this is what we're seeing with inflation of different, you know, products across the world and disturbances everywhere. So this is something that we haven't really experienced in the world that we live in now, which is so interconnected. You can go back to the Spanish flu, I guess, or back to smaller viruses across the world, but they were more contained. This one has really shocked the world politically, financially, economically, and for trade finance as well. So these idioms that we created in the first place were reinforced or were reassessed by force, not because people wanted to change their mind. And this is the world that we're living in now, where we can't control what's happening in different parts of the world. You can only really control what you're doing as a nation state, as a company, and hope that everyone else takes precautions to smooth over the situation.
I don't want to trivialize what you're talking about, but in terms of impact to me, when I was reading the newspaper on the way in today, and I should hasten to add, I don't know if the listeners notice a difference in our tone, because we're actually in the same room. It's the first time we've done a podcast in the same room, and in the same room as Christian, our technical guy. He's what's making the magic happen here with all the fancy equipment, and we've taken a photo, haven't we, just to record this for prosperity in case we can't come back.
We all need a Christian in our lives when we come time to podcast. You
know? Exactly. If we had to rely on our tech skills, we'd be rather desperate. But you know, so if people notice that we're not on Zoom, so it's great to be in our offices back here in London. But you know, when I was coming in today, there was an article in the Times newspaper about, you know, the impact of these some things on our actual. You know, we might have like a basket of goods, but in this case, it was an impact on our Christmas lunch. And I talk about this selfishly because I'm actually going to be making Christmas lunch for my mum's coming down to London. And the good thing is, you know, my mum does, well, people who know my mum know she likes a drink. The good thing is that has not gone up in price, but all the other things have, the vegetables. I suppose the drink not going up is because of the budget and the taxes there have been changed. But the Christmas pudding has gone up. In fact, I bought a Christmas pudding the other day. I did check that it was the sell-by date was going to be after Christmas Day, because it was like the last one on the shelf. And I thought, right, best buy this just in case it runs out. But it's all the other aspects, you know, have all gone up in price since the past year. by way more than inflation now, and that's because of, you know, all the various factors we talked about, you know, along the supply chain, whether that be various goods coming from different parts, the ingredients. But that's just one thing I sort of noticed about the impact on a personal level. But it's just, there's more than that, isn't there?
Mm. There's a lot of things happening in the world that, you know, you can't develop a macro strategy at the beginning without needing to change it as new facts come to be. I mean, because we run a podcast as well, not to take your audience away from you, but we have one as well. And we've spoken to many sort of CIOs of asset managers, which hold, you know, multi-billions under management. And the macro thesis they had at the beginning by force needed to change. And if you don't have that dexterity in your teams to see and react and respond, then you're always going to be left on the back foot. I think that's what we're good at as a firm, because you can't develop macro strategies out of just theory, because something like a pandemic and its impact on finances, you know, the financial world can't stop what's happening, because it's not a financial caused crisis. It's a health caused crisis. Unlike 2008, which was, you know, made by the financiers, could be cured by the financiers. This needs more thought, I think, because you can't control many of the variables. And if you can't control many of the variables, you need to be fluid in how you respond.
And so, yeah, since in Pareto Economics, you know, you told me before we started this that your previous name, Pangaea, people couldn't pronounce that. And as a geographer, I like the concept of Pangaea being, you know, what the world was before it started moving around. But maybe you could explain to me, remind me of what Pareto is all about, because you're a research house and world affairs consultancy, right? And the sort of wider angle, geopolitical side. So it covers quite a few things, but what's the significance of Pareto? It's Italian, I believe.
Pareto Economics comes from Vilfredo Pareto. He was a 19th century, I believe, so economist, engineer, mathematician. And he came up with what is colloquially termed as the Pareto Principle. So the 80-20 rule. And this, when looking into this, even, you know, before I even had the concept of changing the name to this, I found it very interesting. And you can apply it to many aspects of human creativity, whether it's the companies that are being built and the market share they have, whether it's the nations that are in existence and the financial strength they have, the money flows they have, can fall into this Pareto distribution. And using this as a core aspect of seeing the lens in which you can see the world, you can really make sense of a lot of things. And this is what we try to do as a company. Before we had it, you know, we were called Pangaea Wire Group, mostly, you know, to sort of represent the idea that because of globalization, because of technology, we don't need to be on a single landmass, because we're connected in many different ways. And a wire, sort of a news wire, where information and news and technology travels very quickly, you need to be prepared for it. But the name change really captures more significantly what the company does. And the main starting point for what we do is we really try to answer one specific question, macro question for our clients. And that's, how is the world going to be changed and challenged in the next 100 years? And the reason we have this 100 years outlook is because we realize that governments as well as corporations tend to have much shorter term outlooks. A government, typically every election cycle is how far they think. They may have long-term strategies of, oh, the next 50 years we're going to do this, but if you're not in power, you can't do much. Corporations, even less, it's every sort of reporting cycle, every 90 days they need to have their, you know, their ducks in a row. And saying this 100 years, we are saying this is the time frames in which our activity is going to be impacted into the future. And we need to have people in companies, or we need to have someone responsible for these long-term changes and transitions we have as a human species. And we're at this level, we can't only cut it down into regional markets, you know, sub-regional markets, but our impact in so many different ways is felt by so many different people. And especially in trade finance, where it's sort of the oil that allows a machine to run, it plays such a significant role that you cannot take a short-term outlook, especially if you want to plug that trade finance gap of 1.5 trillion, which is extraordinary.
Now, one of the things you told me you've been working on is coming out soon, I believe, the Global Power Index. Now, if you're in trade finance, we do like to abbreviate things, you know, LC, DP, and all that stuff. Have you thought about calling it the GPI?
It is called the GPI.
Oh, okay, well, that wasn't a setup. I didn't know that. So, okay, glad, because we in trade, we do like abbreviations, right. And many of us work for banks or worked for banks that were abbreviations. So that's good. As we call it, a TLA. three-letter acronym, which in itself is a TLA. You see that? Yeah, that's a new one for you.
There. Double entendre right there.
So tell me about that, because the word is Global Power Index. In what kind of context are you talking about power? Yeah.
So essentially this index is how we have been able to quantify the work that we do. So again, if you take it from the starting point of looking at this 100 years outlook, the main sort of depositor of power in this world are nation states, and everything comes from them. Regulation is set by them for companies and banks and all kinds of organizations that play by the rules. You know, people are citizens of them. You know, wars happen between them. Trade happens between them. You know, tariffs are placed on the borders between them. So naturally, for any company which is global or sells into a global market, you need to really understand the trajectory of where nation states are going. And this index is a way to quantify the changes that are happening in nation states for nations themselves to find out what they could be doing better to increase, let's say, for example, foreign direct investment, but also for investors of different kinds, because investors aren't one sort of type of person or entity, to really understand the non-financial risks and opportunities that a nation faces. So the macro thesis behind that is pretty long. I can't really get into it right now because it will probably be here for a while. But essentially, we're saying that the reason as to why nation states, you know, rise in power are fundamentally based on what we call a nation state's centers of power, which are six. And these centers of power allow a nation state to become powerful. And this idea doesn't only apply to nation states of today, but of principalities of past, of empires of the past, and of kingdoms of the past. They've always made sense. They've always mattered. The six are, for example, the nation's geostrategic positioning, their financial strength, their active consumer market, their military balance, their systemically important commodities, which they produce, and also their technological leadership. Throughout history, any empire has been strong because they have maximized themselves in all of these six areas. And if you are not maximizing these six areas, is where we see the developmental differential between nations, which is why America is more powerful, let's say, than Morocco. Not because America somehow is more powerful, but because they've extended themselves maximally on all these six sides in relative to Morocco. So this is a way for investors to see this, and then the back-end research that we've done to create this is one thing, but also the insights you can get from this as an investor, as a trade financier, is incredible.
Yeah. So one of the things just spurred a thought on me is about, you know, if you're looking ahead, have you thought about countries that may not exist now as nation states, but might be there in the future? It's quite a hot topic. As you know, I'm Scottish. Mm-hmm. Because when you're talking about, you know, the influence that things have, so I can't, this is the old Scottish bias thing, you know, television invented by a Scotsman, the telephone, you know, but they were all British, you know, that's the whole thing. Have you looked about, you know, countries that may not exist now and you think that might be around? And that's where we kind of get to looking to the future, because I want to talk to you about what's happening in the future. And that's one thing that is, you know, a fairly hot topic in the UK.
That's actually a really exciting question, Alex, because this has happened before. And I'll tell you in what context it's happened. When we look at the last time where we had a power struggle in the world, meaning between the Soviet Union and the United States, those are the two major powers that really had two different ideologies of how to live and how economics should be managed and how prosperity
still
should be implemented.
Still do, right?
Yeah, but Russia compared, this is, and I'm getting to it, and yeah. Watch this. So you have the United States as a nation state, and you have the Soviet Union as a nation state, but also as a political idea, which was entrenched throughout other nations, right? You had sort of Albania, which wasn't part of the USSR, but also had the communist ideology. You had China, which was also communist. We had, you know, Vietnam, which is still communist, and you had Cuba. And also, you know, fighting for other territories in Africa and also Afghanistan and South America, which also tried to come in with this fresh or with this identity.
Well, when I lived in Calcutta, which was in West Bengal, yeah. That was a communist state, and there was a joke that it'd probably be the last communist state ever, and that was living there when various power cuts and things. It was a kind of anachronism within communism.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, people don't realize that you know, communism spreads to so many, and there were communist parties in so many different countries, which now are seen as democracies. But there was a struggle there. So then, what happened was that when the United States or the Western liberal democratic idea won out, the USSR was broken up into not only Russia, but now what we call the CIS countries, so the nations bordering Russia. So automatically, the USSR had their centers of power, which was compounded by all these nations which weren't created. And then after the USSR fell, these nations became independent and broke off. So they all then developed their own centers of power, which were then created by these six factors. Mm. So we've had examples in the past where an entity like that existed and they got broken up. Now, if you look at Scotland, if you look at, let's say, Northern Cyprus, Taiwan, for example, which is very contentious, Kosovo, and other parts of the world, this can be very easily applied to these nation states if and when they become fully fledged nation states. Mm. So this takes into account these changes and allows you to, again, look at the world through this lens, which is a lot more holistic than just looking at it through a financial lens, which can only capture so much information. Mm. And that's the blind spots that we try to fill with this index.
Yeah, no, there's a lot of very contentious issues around, you know, with the certain idea of nation states. Probably best not to go with. Although it's okay for me as a Scotsman to get into the Scottish one. But you know, and who knows what might happen in the next few years with that. So in terms, you know, your crystal ball, looking ahead, you know, because we're coming to the end of. Well, it's 2021.
Yeah.
And you know, it's been a strange all year. 2020 was a strange year, but you know, I think most of us thought that we would be have turned the corner, and then of course, just as we're getting to the end of it, the new Omicron comes in and sort of changes everything. And it's for like our listeners that are in various countries out in around the world, you know, I'd hope to be traveling by now to visit them.
That's right.
I would have been out to the Middle East, China, Bangladesh, Vietnam, just to name a few, but I've not been out there. And, you know, I was hoping to do that in the first quarter of next year. I'm not so sure that is going to happen quite yet. Mm-hmm. But just wondering, you know, maybe your view of next year is adapted slightly over the past few weeks. Because, of course, that's and what you do, it's always shifting.
Yeah.
You don't know what's going to come around. You've got an idea. So what do you think about 2022?
2022. Now, it depends on who's asking. If you're asking me from a trade finance point of view, there's a position. If you're asking me from someone who maybe sells popcorn on the streets, it's a different position. If you're asking me if you're a cinema company, it's a different outlook. You have different risks and opportunities that come around.
We should cover the trades.
The trade finance, I guess, though, right? So again, this... the macro thesis that we have is out of these centers of power, four different themes emerge in the world, which no matter who you are, no matter if you are a producer of cocoa in Ivory Coast, for example, it will impact you. If you're a teacher in China, it will impact you. If you are a banker in the city of London, where we are right now, it's going to impact you. And these four themes that come up include globalization, geopolitical risk, transformative technology, and societal change. These are the four themes that we see impacting the world a lot more. And what's different about this time period that we are in now is that these four themes are converging at the same time, which is why we see technology being applied to, let's say, the military, or technology being applied to finance, or geopolitics impacting ESG, or these things which before could have been in their silos more strictly are now, there's a lot more blurred lines between them. And a traditional point of view on finance or trade finance or how we do business, this is how we've done it, needs to change.
Yeah, so we can't be saying that this is how we've always done it.
Yeah, exactly. And if you say that's how we've always done it and it's hard to change, naturally it's hard to change because as a company are made up of individuals which have their own biases, which have their own where you are in life as well. You know, you could be a younger guy or girl, have more energy to do it. You may be a bit older and, you know, want to settle down more and have different plans for yourself. So being professional, you know, quote unquote professional is what we try to do on the best days, but that impacts you, your outlook on the world and who you decide to listen to.
Well, we had a similar situation at LIBF in terms of last year where, you know, we wanted to make our exams all on demand, all online delivery. But it was we knew it was going to be a lot of work. And also we thought that maybe not everybody would be so keen on the concept, you know. But needs of being as they were, we did that, and it's been a success, I'm glad to say. And, you know, a number of listeners will have done their exams online, or they should be booking them up. I like to say, use this opportunity to remind people who have exams to book, please book them up. because there's a few, even if the beauty of it is if they make the booking, they can still change at a later date if there's another lockdown, for example. But you know, that was one of those things where it was quite difficult to do, and it was like, well, we're going to have to do it. And I think there's been a lot of cases of that around the world where people have been putting things off, and then it's a situation where if they don't do it, they wouldn't be around. Yeah, so spurred on a lot of people.
It needs to be, and especially working from home and all these different dynamics. Before the pandemic, you know, companies would say, oh, it's too difficult, we can't do it, but they were forced into change. Sometimes forcing you into change makes you see a new perspective. But going back to the themes of 2022, from your point of view, if I were to just ask you, working in the trade finance world more deeply, what conversations have you heard from your colleagues that you didn't expect to hear last year that they're concerned about? And then maybe I can give some insights into that, which is more specific for the audience.
Well, because of that, the aspect, it's this trade digitalization, and that's the main focus. And you know, the ICC UK, Chris, I've spoken to him about that aspect. Everything in trade is about digitalization, and that has accelerated very, very quickly. And that's because it's one of those same thing, you know, needs must. But then there's also, it's not in isolation. There are some cost savings, might be some initial costs, but the cost savings. The problem whenever that is talked about, trade digitalization, is about, you know, the regulatory side, the legal side, and, trying to have some sort of commonality globally. And that's with, you know, standardization. You have, you know, in some of the technology earlier adopters, you know, the banks with some of the technology, they would rather be a fast follower. They'd rather let one bank. Yeah. I mean, and that's with any technology, people, if they're going to buy a new car, a lot of people who got the Tesla early on were not, there weren't that many. Now it's, people are reliant, they understand the tech, and they're keen to have it. But those people who are willing to early adopt, they're taking a bit of a risk. In the same way with banks on the digital side. So I would say on the trade world, for me, what I hear about mostly, and then going to conferences and talking, and also I do some consultancy work on that as well, it's about trade digitalization.
Yeah, that's a big thing. And we weren't going to talk too much about cryptos, but I think we have to go there because the fundamental building blocks of cryptos, blockchain, and efficiency gains, as you mentioned, cost saving gains are huge if they're applied in ways that work. But the trouble is, having these technologies being applied to the trade finance world, you need a focus, you need an organization, you need participants in the trade finance world to say, we are willing to spend time, money, and effort learning about how this can be applied. Which is why organizations like ITFA and you guys here and other organizations are key in making sure that the attention that your members have or your colleagues have, they have a place to meet and discuss to have these things happen in real time.
I was on a webinar yesterday, a panelist for the UAE Banks Federation, and it was about fraud, and it was a discussion about consortia. Because a lot of banks are getting together to do some of these things because there's economies of scale, it was about a case of being like a club or a consortium, but not a closed like a private members club. They want more people to join, yeah. So that's a slightly different thing. Whereas some things in the past might have been slightly more closed. A lot of these things moving forward is they want the more membership, the better. Yeah. So you'll see a lot more of those kind of organizations, but of course it's difficult because different banks have different policies and approaches, And there'll be a number of listeners who have worked with some of these consortia and can be frustrating for some people.
Yeah, yeah. But also, if you look at the trade finance world, I mean, what the pandemic has done most of is maybe stop deal flow as much, meaning you have producers of commodities across the world. Because of COVID, they don't have, you know, workers to then, let's say pick fruits and vegetables, or can't go into factories and do things. So their production has slowed down. Demand has also slowed down for the end consumer because they can't go out and spend. So the actual facilitation of trade finance has been less, I can assume, since the pandemic has come about, because there's no, the demand and supply has been so restricted that they want the supply and demand to come back to levels which can sustain business, and which allow maybe smaller banks, and also lending organizations to have the incentives to come back and to work again. Not work again in terms of actually coming into the office, but having the deal flow for you to put the money down to secure a trade and to have all the systems in place. And this is what the pandemic has stopped. And this is how much we realize supply chains matter when they go wrong. Because when they go right, no one thinks about it, it's business as usual. But when things like this happen, this is why technology tries to be the bridge to help some of these efficiency gains, so that you can actually, the best you can, not have the reason why we didn't develop, because we didn't develop the technology. So that's the easiest thing to control. The hardest thing to control is a global pandemic, and then how do you start with that? But if you can control what kinds of technologies you use, what the standards are, working with the regulators and building a framework, that's what you can control. That's what banks and trade finance functions of banks should be doing more so. Over-communication as opposed to fear and staying in silos. You need to be over-communicating with your clients, with your partners across the world.
Do you work in the world of trade and transaction banking? Maybe you aspire to work in that sector. Our qualifications are recognized internationally and studied in over 90 countries. Thousands of people qualify with us and progress their careers every year. We have 6 qualifications that focus on international trade finance, LCs, guarantees, financial crime, payments, and supply chain finance. Wherever you are in your career, we might have the solution to take you to the next level. Find out more at libf.ac.uk/trade. And we were talking about, you know, the people working there, and you know, my concern is that there isn't much more working from home. Okay, and so even like trade teams, and I talked about it on the webinar yesterday, is that because people are not sitting beside each other so much, they're not having discussions, whether it be simple, selfish things from LIBF's perspective about, you know, doing trade qualifications. They're also not having support, because, you know, when I was at HSBC, people would go into meeting rooms at the end of the day and sort of help with working work study groups. They're not so easy to be doing those things online. But, you know, from a fraud perspective, you know, people are not, they have a kind of suspicion or something, and they can't just go and say to somebody who sits close to them, you know, to having to like call them up on a video. And that's what I worry about, because there hasn't been so much of this interpersonal contact. So people are not, helping with each other with their education, learning as much. And also, you know, on the fraud side, you know, that kind of sharing that sort of stuff, because you've got people who are joining organizations who have never actually physically met their colleagues. So how do they know that that person is, you know, would willingly help them with a query? What you're also not getting is you're not getting somebody overhearing you and saying, if they're a decent person, going, oh, I can help you with that, or I've seen that case before. Because on the trade side, a number of the things that have happened in the past, you know, you learn by your mistakes. Some of my biggest learnings while I've been in trade, and I think many of the listeners will identify with this, is when you've made a mistake, you know. And some people don't like to, it can be a bit embarrassing when you made a mistake, but I was one that tried to share those things so that other people wouldn't, especially people within HSBC, didn't want them making the same mistake you have. And those opportunities in all banks and all organizations are not there so much because people are not working as closely as they did in the past. Have you thought about how that kind of is going to affect? Because there will be some, you know, some aspects of work where people will have to be close to each other. But how, what do you think about that's going to affect things in the future?
Well, this is a question which I think, not to sort of offend your age, but maybe the older generation think more about, because naturally throughout history, we've never really had a situation where you can build companies and work in companies from the comfort of your sofa. So without having an example of how they've done it before, technology may try to overcompensate and provide features in their softwares which help you, but naturally as a human being, you may not use them. And if you don't use them and you're paying for them, that's going to, you know, impact your bottom line in terms of the services you you pay for. But on a more human level, you need to find a way to have these unexpected interactions and having the cohesiveness in a technological way. And the idea of the metaverse is trying to do that, but I don't think nothing will come close like me and you speaking today. Because if we were on Zoom, you know, technological issues, I couldn't see your body language. I wouldn't know when to come in and talk. Something as easy as this, which for the listener, they enjoy the podcast more.
And we haven't been saying you're on mute.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So this is good. This is a big, I think the impacts of this are going to be felt not now, but probably the next 5 years, more so. Because an innovation, meaning working from home now, the actual impacts of that can't be felt straight away. You can see this straight away in terms of, like right now in this place, barely anyone's in the office physically, but they're all at home. But what are you, are people more efficient working from home? That depends on them. And companies are naturally going to have to change their tune. Twitter, for example, have said, now we have a policy where you can work from home all the time. Right? And if you work from home for companies which, where you may not need to be, for example, backend, the backend, let's say finance or treasury or compliance even, don't need to be maybe in the room as much as maybe the front end people or the innovators of a company. Not to say compliance isn't innovative, because my wife's in compliance and she's not going to like me saying that. But that's the case, you know? So how do you find people who need to be in a room more together stay in a room, right? That's what you need to figure out. That's each individual company needs to make that choice. But to go back, if you can, to how 2022, because I remember when we met in Helsinki, I said, how is trade finance going to be impacted in 2021, right? So we're kind of full circle almost in February now. So, and this is what I mentioned also then, and it's going to be even more so now. Now, when people, especially in trade finance or finance in general, hear the word geopolitics, right? The department that cares the most is probably compliance. It's probably the risk function. Because that's what that is the area of work that's going to be the most impacted, or you need to be able to see how sanctions impact that, right? And if you look at the state of the world today, we have historical grievances between the big superpowers, which aren't going to be solved anytime soon, compounded by the impact of COVID, compounded by the impact of smaller nation states not trusting the bigger ones as much, because you're helping yourselves by overbuying, you know, vaccines and not allowing us to have it, causing a lot of frustration. I've spoken to nation states, you know, high level representatives about this, and they are frustrated by the lack of action to the words that, you know, the superpowers have. And this was seen by COP26, and, you know, lastminute.com, we had India and China put in some clauses which allowed them to, you know, produce coal more so than what they agreed on before. Mm. So global trust and global alliance building has been tested by COVID. But if you look at the sanctions world, for example, this is something that every compliance person should know, or probably does know, is that when Putin and Biden had their teleconference today and yesterday, because it goes on for a few days, and let's say if Biden does put heavy sanctions on Russia because of their planned activities in invading, quote-unquote, Ukraine, okay? Who's that going to impact the most? Naturally, trade finance is going to feed it, because those exporters from Russia can't then export their pork or can't export whatever to Western markets. So the amount of money that you can make as a trade finance facilitator is going to be less. And especially if it's a market as big as Russia, it's going to be less. And if this is popping up all across the world because of, as we go back to a nation's centers of power, nation and geopolitics being a bigger factor, you know, tariffs going up even, so tariffs going up or non-tariff restrictions, this is going to lessen trade amongst nation states, which is going to have a big impact on a trade finance bottom line.
Well, I saw that years ago, you know, with Iran in the Middle East, you know, where suddenly there was a whole load of banks were doing a lot of business with Iran and then couldn't, and their bottom line,
that's right.
And that will happen, you know, other cases of that happening throughout the world.
I can tell you some stories offline after this about some big cases of companies, you know, really seeing the impact of this. And actually companies need to have a united front, but it impacts them big time afterwards, you know. So again, geopolitics becomes a big issue for trade finance. Globalization becomes a big topic. And as technology impacts us speaking here today with Zoom, it's going to impact in a bigger way things of scale like trade finance, which given the trade finance gap now, which last time I checked, was 1.5 trillion.
Right? I do wonder how they work it out.
Yeah.
But because the number I hear is
it's
about
opportunity
that.
It's the opportunity missed. So they're probably looking at what businesses right now are functioning in the areas where trade finance is less developed, and what could be the opportunity gain if they were to be offered trade finance services.
But the number I hear is always about 1.5 trillion.
Something like this. And I had a conversation with Duarte Pedrera from Crown Agents. He's a good friend of mine. And, you know, he spoke about, you know, smaller banks, which are more domestic banks in Africa and in other parts of the world who operate there, have more of a hands-on approach to what's happening there. And they're probably more able and more willing to set foot, because you have compliance issues with anti-money laundering, financial crime, which no one wants to get in trouble with at all, because the reputation risk alone will be enough to cause big troubles, let alone, you know, the financial impacts of that and everything else along with that. So, which is natural, because no one wants to be facilitating financial crime, but in areas where nations, their own compliance or their own regulations aren't as developed, you're going to have these gaps in trade finance. And those who are working on it are trying their best way to have maybe non-banking players, maybe even family offices. We have Andre Kasterman, a friend of mine, who's working on these solutions as we speak, on the digitization of trade finance and finding solutions. But for big corporations, like you mentioned HSBC, you know, to adopt them, there's going to be a lot of, a lot of security, a lot of assurances they need to have that they're doing the right thing, because they're, you know, too big to be in trouble again, I guess, for these things. So these are issues which you need a key person in an organization that really focuses on it and works with innovators to try to find solutions to this. And globalization, geopolitics, I think, is something which is probably the least understood by the banking world. And I say that, you know, very confidently, only because we have, let's say, the oil and gas world, which operate in these fields a lot more.
Literally.
Yeah, exactly. They're there on the ground doing so. They have more of an understanding and awareness of how geopolitics impacts them. Banks, right now, we have Western banks going to Asia and across the world, and some Asian banks penetrated here, right? But the foreign banks which come into Western markets don't really need to think about geopolitics as much, because it's more or less more stable than it is the other way around. So, I'm not going to say who, but I had a conversation with this asset manager a long while ago. And we were just speaking about, he was a chief investment officer. And I said to him, so who does your geopolitics? Like, how do you guys focus on this? Because for them, investing in emerging markets, you need to have someone, I believe, that's focusing on it. He goes, oh, you know, we don't do geopolitics. I said, oh, why? He goes, oh, we read the FT. You know? So I thought, well, if that's the level of due diligence that you're having, you know, this is incredible. So you find these stories in different organizations, especially if you're based in the city, you're in a bubble, you know, really much so.
That does help you for your work, surely.
Exactly, but then that's when I thought, listen, if this is the case here, how do you capture these people who may believe it's important but haven't seen solutions to this? Which is what we're doing with the index is a way in, easy way in to understand the world. We have different sort of innovations that we're developing, which is a good way to see it, to compare it, and then to jump in with what you need to understand, and we can provide that for you.
Because just when we talk about geopolitical risk, you know, you can talk about so many different levels.
Exactly.
And, you know, there's some more simplified ways, and people will maybe, that probably touches on the things they maybe read in the press.
Yeah, headline risk that comes up. People read it and they get afraid.
Yeah, so then they'll see things about, say, China and Taiwan, Russia and Ukraine. Yeah. Scotland and England. Yeah. You know. but they'll see those things, but then they won't be looking in more closely and then thinking about the implications. Because if you know, when I was at high school, you know, people used to do, before these computer games, Dungeons and Dragons, and they'd be thinking about different implications. You go along one route, and I suppose that's what you have to do yourselves on the geopolitical side. You think it, because you go along one route, and that means that there's a whole avenue and it can split on different ways. Yeah. But it's each time it's about something, some event happens which will dictate the next route. Yeah. And so it's like, must be sort of a big sort of matrix you're looking at.
This is the conversations we have with clients all the time. We come in when, you know, the proverbial, you know, SHIT hits the fan, you know, and what do we do? And you should have thought about this, you know, before
a few years ago, before
the egg hatched, you know?
Yeah.
Not right now. And if you call us in right now, then it's going to be a lot more for you to fix.
So what kind of, I obviously can't talk about specific cases, but what kind of things have you seen in the past where maybe a bit of foresight on the geopolitical side could have saved somebody?
Listen, it depends on who you're sitting in with the bank. I think it's more clinical because they have, it's easier with our clients in the banking world than it is maybe for our clients in the oil and gas world or in the tech world or even in the NGO space. Each person, each organization have their own needs, you know. When we speak to, you know, banking or financial clients, it's more sort of what should we be aware of in the long term, because their individual practices are so big that to execute on smaller things is hard to do with sort of a workshop or hard to do with a report, you know. But the thing that I find the most is that when we speak to anyone we speak to, when we speak about geopolitics, the first thing that the biggest names, Russia, China, Iran, are the first things that come up. But in reality, you know, the biggest impact that is in your business may not be any of these guys. Mm. It could be Mongolia, right? It could be Nepal. It could be what's happening here. It could be something which you connect to geopolitics only because there's a politician speaking, you know?
Well, that's our annual trade finance compliance conference. One of the things we were talking about trying to understand from, you know, especially on the people on the sanctions side, it was about what do they see as future issues, you know. So, but, you know, that was already, you know, this was just after the troops had left Afghanistan. So that was already aware of. And then, you know, the Russian piece, the China piece, those are all things that being aware of, but they talked about a few other cases where, you know, you're looking further ahead, that you can see sort of rumblings. So what kind of thing, do you see anything like that of, you know, issues that you see further ahead and that maybe, you know, the ones that we're not seeing in the headlines?
I get this question a lot, whether it's on, whether it's podcasts or whether it's, you know, people asking me just what are the things that we're not paying attention to.
It's the same old question from Alex.
You know? But I think it's not about what you're not paying attention to, but how do you interpret what's happening, right? As opposed to what's not, because everything's being paid. Like with this, the way that the world works, everyone has a spotlight somewhere, but it's, do you see it, you know? But the one thing which I ask like, how do you define geopolitics, you know? And it's hard. And then I say, so how do you define political risk? They say, well, it's the risk of politics. Well, how do you find geopolitical risk? And they're stumped. But these things, as definitions, are very clear. You know, and so sometimes starting with the basics to understand the framework of how you should be thinking is important. For example, to give your audience some sort of steps to understand it, political risk, for example, are risks which happen within a nation state, right? Within a country. So it's regulatory, part of it is what a government is doing, which stops you from doing business in that country or hinders you from doing business in that country.
So that, right? As an example, that could be, you know, the stuff related to the HS2, you know, they would have it in the Leeds and then they decided not to, and that would have ramifications. Yeah,
exactly.
So that's a political
thing. Political risk, right? So it's what decisions they're making for the domestic market. That's a political risk. A geopolitical risk are risks which come about between nation states. Right, so bilateral or multilateral risk. So that's things like sanctions, right? That's things like Russia wants to invade Ukraine. How does that impact us? So between nations, that's a geopolitical risk.
So something, just to help with my understanding of that. So something that, you know, so climate change.
Yeah.
You know, Yeah. All that COP, that's all geopolitical.
That's all because it's between nation states, right? Yeah. And people think Juba is only about guns and bullets and tanks. No, it's between nations. And what conversation they're having, that's the risk that you face as a business.
But then, of course, a lot of it stems from the political risk, because a country, let's say the UK, has a policy for climate change, but that will impact other countries, won't it?
For example, look... because you have things like Brexit, which are both political and geopolitical, right? Because it impacts the domestic. But let's say, for example, raising tax on gin, right? For a producer of gin in the UK, that could be, again, a political risk. For a gin importer, could be a geopolitical one, right? But people interchange these two things as if it's the same thing. Like in corporate insurance, you have political risk, right? Not geopolitical risk. You have terrorism risk for that, because it could... more be of how other non-state actors are impacting the world. But political risk is very well defined even in the insurance market. It's the risks that are caused by political decisions on business, on the domestic markets. So something as simple as that. And also, just for your audience to know, it's maybe a little plug that we're developing a world affairs dictionary, which defines some very basic concepts and concepts that we've developed ourselves, i.e. the centers of power, or global power index, developmental differential. We're creating a dictionary which explains these terms to a financial or any audience which wants to learn about them, which gives you straight definition and examples of them, just so you know what language you're using. Oh, yeah. Because sometimes the difference of language, like even using acronyms, can be confusing, let alone actual words, which people may have a perception of what they mean. Being very clear on what you're saying and what you mean is really a good step to having a clear strategy in the future.
Well, yeah, with an acronym, with abbreviations or whatever, and depending on what context, if you look up something on the internet, depending on what context, it can be four or five different things. Exactly. It can be different to a logistics company than to a bank.
Exactly.
So in terms of, we'll have to like close in a few minutes, but to just thinking about the future, we covered quite a lot of it. Mm-hmm. But what would you say, in terms of your looking ahead for 2022, what is your kind of...
What you should do?
Yeah.
I think you should pay less attention to headline risk. Because if it's out on Bloomberg, it's already happened.
Yes, it's too late.
If the journalists are there, then there's no point. And this...
So it's like the stock market.
Yeah, exactly.
If people are talking about that, it's too late. The horse is bolted, right?
I mean, we've done surveys with audience, and we asked them, what are the ways in which you learn about geopolitical risk, for example? And they say, well, the majority of it is just newspapers. Do you do anything deeper than that? Not really. So if you're only reading newspapers, like that newspaper isn't written just for you and your business. So paying attention so much and then bringing it into the office, oh, let's talk about this. I mean, this could be a good introduction to the topic, but you can't then make this off the basis of a news headline. So less of that, and more going to the source. So that's something that you can do more so. So for example, if a report comes out, don't read the interpretation of the report through a newspaper, or through a blog, or through your daily newsletter or email that you get, highlights, right? Who cares? But highlights don't give you trajectory,
Well, in that respect, when I listened to the news this morning, and it was about Australia are not going to be involved diplomatically with the Winter Games in China.
Yeah.
But I'm thinking, okay, I'm just hearing about that now, but that must have been going on for ages.
They've made decisions about this before it came out, and they wish that some things wouldn't come out in the news, right? So if you're only capturing it through sort of the conduit, you're not capturing everything. You're not capturing the whole value. So to go more to the source. That's the thing that we do. If you have any reports that are quoted, anything that you go to the source, read it in its full context. That way you can really learn more about it,
Because that's a good example of like a geopolitical thing. So you've got a situation between China and Australia, and it's about, in theory, it's about the sport, but it's not. It's way more. But that's going to impact, a farmer in Australia, or people who are looking to buy products importing from China, and suddenly, overnight, their whole world has been turned upside down. They're probably because of that, they'll be if they're importing, say, wool or lamb from Australia, that's probably going to be a lot more difficult now, and just so that's where the kind of those people. Haven't sort of thought about this.
Again, how do you connect those dots by just a news article? How? Because listen, I'm on TV a lot. I'm not saying that to but I get contacted by journalists almost on a daily basis for my insights. In fact, I was going to meet someone today. I'm going to share this podcast. I think he knows who he is. I was going to meet him today, but he couldn't make it. And but I get these requests all the time to speak, right? And journalists want to get your insights into it. And they put together a piece from their own knowledge of the situation. But a journalist is not going to have access to, for example, the decision-making processes of the cabinet. So they're going to give you what they can as a summary to help you understand the high levels. But if you take these high levels and make decisions off the base of it, that's where you go wrong straight away. You know, you need to, or better yet, hire us and we can help you, essentially, if you want. But without going, without saying it, that obviously.
It's the same way when I join other people for their podcast, I always do a plug for LIBF. Yeah. So,
example, because even if you sit down with us for an hour to talk about what's going on, even to do sort of like a health check MOT on 2022, right? What are your plans? What do you want to achieve? What should you focus on? You may have gaps in X, Y, and Z. How do you fill these gaps? What members of the team are working on this, right? What sources should you be reading more of and less of? You know, where are you getting the information from? You know, this is what you should be focusing on. This is what you could be doing better or worse, just to set you up more. Just like you speak to a personal trainer, you may not train that person every single day, but they give you the meal plan, what you should be doing. It's up to you to stick to it, right? And if you stick to it, you see benefits, then you know this person works.
You just reminded me, I've just started doing that with an online fitness and health thing. Yeah. So
you can do Zoom calls as well. Don't worry.
I'm starting to feel guilty about that. But no, so that what the people who are listening to this and they will be able to get in touch with you on LinkedIn because you're active there as well. And we can provide some details. That's the beauty of being in the same room as Christian. Exactly. He's given me the nod as opposed to giving me the eyes across his mask. He's giving me a nod. So we're all okay. So we can pass on your details so people might be interested.
Yeah. But I'm active on LinkedIn. I write a lot about different topics, even thoughts that I have, just put it there. Engage with people, you know, speak what you think people need to know. Not through just any sort of marketing way or saying something for this, or having, you know, these days I see a lot of LinkedIn, polls that people do, just, you know, obvious things like, do you like sleeping during the day or the night, right? Obviously, but they just want to get the attention on them, you know? But if you do that, you know, you're not saying what you should be saying. So LinkedIn, Twitter, I guess a little bit, website, that's where you can find me.
Cool. But yeah, well, thanks so much for coming in. Yeah, as we're set here in London, most of our listeners are outside London, and they won't. There's a storm coming in, Storm Barra, and so we probably best get away before it hits. Yeah. It's getting dark outside. But the good thing about London at this time of year, when it does get dark, we've got lovely Christmas lights. So as we step out into the cold, we'll have a Christmas feel about it. Just like to say, Clisman, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And thanks to Christian, because this is his cool back to, he's got his brand new equipment. He's literally like a boy in a sweetie shop here with all his new equipment. He's finally getting to use it. So thanks to you, Christian. And to all our listeners, all the best of the festive season, no matter how you celebrate that. And at some point we'll be getting to 2022, and then maybe at the end of next year we'll make this an annual thing where we'll get back. We'll take notes on what you predicted. And but thanks very much, and to all listeners, all the best for the coming year. Thank you. Thanks for listening. We have a great number of other episodes on this channel, and even other LIBF podcast channels that dive into more banking and finance topics. So make sure to check them out as well. All the links are in the description.